welcome to Rabble Radio. It's the week of Friday, November 25th. I'm your host and the editor of Rabble.ca, Chelsea Nash. Rabble breaks down the news of the day from a progressive lens. It's a good place to catch up and catch on to what's happening in Canadian politics, activism, environment, and so much more. Listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We catch you up on the news of the week and take you further into the stories that matter to you. This week on the show, we welcome back Libby Davies as she interviews political scientist Dr. Jeanette Ash about the state of women in politics in Canada. Dr. Ash is the chair of the Political Science Department at Douglas College and visiting faculty at the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, King's College in London. She is the author of Political Candidate Selection: Who Wins, Who Loses, and Underrepresentation in the UK. Her other recent publications include Gender Sensitivity Under Trudeau, Facebook Feminism or Real Change, and Canada's Political Parties, Gatekeepers to Parliament. She advises legislatures, parties, and organizations on assessing gender and diversity sensitivity, and advises legislators on drafting legislation on gender equity and democratic reform. Libby Davies, as you may remember from last week, is the author of Outside In, a political memoir. She served as the MP for Vancouver East from 1997 through 2015 and is former NDP deputy leader and house leader. She is also a recipient of the Order of Canada. Libby and Jeanette discuss the barriers that continue to exist for women in Canadian politics, despite the fact that the electorate is actually more likely to support women candidates when they do appear on the ballot. After an election like the one we just had, which saw the Liberals lose 4 female cabinet ministers, that was an ouch, it's a good time to once again examine how our political parties here in Canada can actually create and uphold barriers for women and other diverse candidates. Here's their conversation. Take a listen.
Well, thank you so much, Jeanette Ash, for joining me today. It's wonderful to be able to have this conversation with you about a big issue, women in politics. I know that you're the chair of the Political Science Department at Douglas College. You're well published. You do a lot of research about women in politics. Very happy to talk with you today about this subject because I think it's on a lot of our minds about how we're doing in terms of gender representation in the political arena. And I thought we could begin by just reflecting for a bit on the recent federal election. There's a marginal improvement. There's 103 women who were elected to the House of Commons, so we finally hit the 30% representation of the whole parliament, up slightly from 29% from the 2019 election. And of the 49 new members of parliament, 22 are women, so almost half are women. So maybe we could begin there. I mean, those are the numbers, but of course, what's interesting is what is behind the numbers. And I'm just wondering, Jeanette, if you have any reflections or sense of what happened in that federal election as it relates to primarily gender, but also diversity overall in Canada's parliament.
The 2021 federal election result was really, really disappointing. There was a lot of hype going into the election because there were a record number of women candidates and women candidates who identified as Indigenous or as Black or as people of color. And there were a record number of candidates who just generally were Indigenous and Black and people of color. But as you mentioned, the results were really disappointing. Just looking at women, for example, at dissolution of Parliament just before the election, there were 102 women?
I think it was 100 women.
Oh, it's 100 women. So dissolution of parliament, there are 100 women. And with the election result, we have, 103 women? Mm-hmm. So that's a 1 percentage point increase. So 29% up to 30%. If we look to the last few elections, we saw in 2015, what was the percentage? 26%. The election before that, it was 25%. So over the last 4 elections or so, we've only seen an increase of a few percentage points. And what is behind this? There is a myth that one of the reasons that women and other equity deserving groups are underrepresented is because they don't come forward. You know, they don't seek selection. They don't seek candidacy. So there's a real blame that's placed on the underrepresented group. But if you really look at it closely, you have to look at the gatekeepers to the corridors of power. So the gatekeepers to office, and the gatekeepers to office in a parliamentary system like Canada, where parties are so strong, are the parties. So it's the parties' selection processes that are really keeping equity-deserving groups like women and like people who identify as Indigenous or Black or people of color or LGBTQ as plus out of those powerful positions. So a lot of the research that I've done focuses on this and works to dispel that myth that blames the underrepresented group. So if you look at all of the people who actually apply to become a candidate for a political party, and then you look at the people who are actually selected by party members as the official candidate to stand in election, you'll see that they don't really match up. There's a disproportional number of men getting through compared to women. And this is especially the case in winnable seats. So in parties' target seats and parties' winnable seats. So we might have record number of women standing for office, and that is certainly something to celebrate. So we've seen an increase in supply, and that is a good thing. We see parties putting in more effort to recruit women. So that is good. But when we look at the number and, of course, the percentages that are selected, we really, really haven't seen a huge improvement, especially in terms of being elected. So that's the problem. So we have to look more closely at parties' selection processes.
For the women who are running, is part of the barrier the response of the electorate, or do you see it primarily as a party issue in that the party is still allowing systemic barriers and obstacles to stay in place, the status quo, the old, you know, the old boys club? Or what role does the electorate play when those women are running? Are they having a harder time getting elected?
No, not at all. And there's been research on this that shows that the electorate does not discriminate against women candidates. In fact, there's a slight bias towards women candidates. And we also know that in some parties, in some countries, parties have kind of clued into this and they see, okay, there might actually be an electoral advantage to selecting more women in target and winnable seats because the electorate actually likes them. So this is a real, it's kind of a wake-up call, I think. And there's been a lot of resistance amongst parties in this country and other countries as well to putting in place policies that are directed at formally increasing the percentage of women and other equity deserving groups in winnable seats.
You've been doing some work with the Parliamentary Commonwealth Association in Ottawa, and I know a lot of your writing and publishing and research has focused on other countries as well. You're a fellow at the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at King's College London in the UK. So you have kind of a broader lens as well. So it would be very interesting to hear how you see Canada relative to other places that you've also been looking at, and what kind of work it is that you're doing with the Commonwealth Association.
Okay, so Canada comparatively is not doing well in terms of women's representation. It has fallen behind many other countries, and the rate of increase in terms of women's representation has really stalled. And, you know, if you look at other countries, no established democracy parliaments fully or truly represents the people that are in the population. And this, of course, includes Canada. And there's been a lot of criticism directed at Canada, and especially since Prime Minister Trudeau. And Trudeau, of course, when he became Prime Minister, leading a Liberal majority in 2015, one of the first things that he did was he appointed Canada's first federal sex balance cabinet. And when asked why, he said, because it's 2015. There was a lot of excitement around this, having the first federal appointed sex balance cabinet. And Trudeau called himself over and over a feminist. So we thought, okay, this is great. We're going to see a lot of change within Canada's parliamentary institution. We're going to see, you know, greater gender sensitivity in terms of appointment to, you know, committee chairs, this kind of thing. But it's been, again, pretty disappointing. I did do a study that came out last year, actually, called Facebook Feminism, and it compares Stephen Harper's tenure and Justin Trudeau's tenure. And the idea there is thinking, well, if Trudeau's a feminist, we're going to see Parliament become a much more gender-sensitive institution. And it has become more gender-sensitive, but not by as much as we had expected. So this just kind of reflects this performative kind of gestures towards feminizing the institution. And one of the things toward that is, of course, increasing the representation of women. But we really haven't seen the kinds of changes that we had hoped. And getting back to the underrepresentation of women, and it's systemic, right? Why are women underrepresented? It's not women's fault. They do come forward. They come forward in high enough numbers to fill candidacies many times over. So if women are 51% of the population, a fair process, a fair selection process would mean that women would make up 51% of members of parliament or 51% of MLAs in the provincial legislature. But that's just not the case. We have 30%, which is a record in terms of members of parliament right now. So as you asked earlier, like what is behind that? Again, it's institutional. And if we really, you know, pull back the curtains, it is the selection process of parties. And again, it's not the electorate. They do like women candidates. They select them and when they run in winnable seats. So if you pull back the curtains on party selection processes, where we do see women getting selected, they're not getting selected at the same rates in winnable or target seats as men. One of the reasons for this is party members, they can only choose one candidate to represent their party in an electoral district. And by default, they often will select the person that most resembles who has historically been successful in the past. And of course, if you look at our parliaments, they historically comprised, initially 100% of white professional straight men. So they think, okay, we have one chance at getting our candidate elected. So we ought to choose the person who most looks like the successful politician, the sort of standard model candidate. And so that's what they tend to do. And I've done studies where with everything held equal, so women and men having the same kinds of political experience, education levels, all that kind of thing, that party members are up to 5 times more likely to choose a man in a winnable seat or a safe seat over a woman or than a woman. And that's quite striking. And to me, that says, okay, that's a demand side problem. That's an institutional bias at the party level where party members are probably not even aware that they're doing this. That's the thing. It's not even a conscious thing. They're just kind of defaulting to the standard model. So they're selecting men, especially in these safe seats. And you know, these extremely qualified women are just left to the wayside. So it's a demand side problem. And we really have to address this. One way is to formally encourage parties. You can incentivize parties, or you could, penalize parties for not selecting a certain percentage of women or people from other equity deserving groups. And this could be in the form of a sex quota, where you create an artificial demand temporarily. So we do get that boost in the percentage.
Has that been done anywhere?
In Canada, where we see that is in British Columbia. The BC legislature, the BC New Democratic Party, has had in place an equity mandate for several years. And that has resulted in the BC NDP having a caucus that is a majority women. There was initially a lot of resistance to the equity mandate, but now the results are celebrated. And the policy itself is celebrated too. And in New Brunswick recently has in place a policy to incentivize parties to select more women candidates as well. But other than that, there's no formal measures in place to ensure parties select a 50% women candidates in safe seats. There was an attempt federally, Bill 237, the Gender Equity Elections Canada Act, that was proposed. It was a private member's bill by Kennedy Stewart, which I worked on, and alongside me, many, many academics from across Canada and in Ireland and in the UK. So we had a lot of organizations behind this. And this bill was targeting lack of demand amongst party members. And we saw it as an opportunity to increase women's representation because Trudeau was feminist prime minister. And so we thought this is another window of opportunity. But unfortunately, even though we did get liberals on side, the bill did fail. And the bill has been successful in other countries, like a similar type of policy has been successful in Ireland and in France, for example. And it's not a quota, but what it does is it encourages parties to select more women and to select people from equity deserving groups. If they do, then they won't lose some of their public subsidy because parties are publicly subsidized. So, you know.
You've talked about the systemic issue of political parties not doing what they need to do to create the opportunities for women to run successfully. You've talked about how the electorate actually is very welcoming and supportive of women who are running. Another layer, I think, is what happens to women when they are elected? What is their experience like? And I wonder if the research that you've been doing with the Commonwealth Association in Ottawa, Parliamentary Association, is focusing on that at all, or whether other research that you've done is looking at what happens afterwards, you know? What is the experience of women? Are they facing a hostile environment? Are there still barriers that women face once they actually do get elected and may become a cabinet minister or a parliamentary secretary or whatever it might be?
So in 2020, I had a book published, Political Candidate Selection, Who Wins, Who Loses, and Underrepresentation, looking at the supply of women and other diverse candidates coming forward and parties acting as gatekeepers and not selecting them to winnable and target seats. And the results that came out of this book, I've done similar studies in Canada as well, and they're all very much the same. So I started thinking, you know, it's not just about getting women elected. It's also what happens when they get to parliament. Are they promoted? Do they feel heard? Do they feel welcome? Are they intimidated? Are they harassed? What is the workplace like? And the United Nations Interparliamentary Union a few years ago started to put together a toolkit for gender-sensitive assessments. And I started doing these assessments as well as working with Sarah Childs, who is now at University of Edinburgh. And she wrote The Good Parliament, which assesses the British Parliament in terms of gender sensitivity. So I started to do this, and the study that I did, Facebook Feminism, Trudeau versus Harper, that really plays up on the initial gender and diversity assessment. So I started to get interested in doing a gender and diversity sensitive assessment in the BC legislature. And that report came out this year, and it comes up with a methodology to assess the gender and diversity assessment of the BC legislature as a case model. And then I'm now working with the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, the Commonwealth Women's Parliamentarians, coming up with a assessment of Canada's parliaments and the Senate and the provincial legislatures as well. And it's just looking to see what these places are like as workplaces, whether when you get there, you feel that you are doing the work that you set out to do, whether you can fully participate, and if there's any obstacles to that participation. So that can include things like getting promoted as a chair or to a committee, or whether you feel like you are being valued, whether you're having an input into policy, whether you get questions during question period, whether the space itself actually reflects the diversity of the community, all these kinds of things. And that is what I'm looking at right now. So I'm undertaking this project, which includes surveying members of provincial legislatures and Canada's parliament, and also interviewing people, and
When do you hope to finish that research, Jeanette? Will it be published in the next year or so, or how long?
Probably next year. Probably next year. Yeah.
Fascinating. I mean, it so needs to be done. I'm really glad that you're digging into that. We've just got a few minutes left, and I want to come back to your hometown, Vancouver, because I know that you're very involved locally as well. And so what makes you tick, Jeanette? What is it that you've got your professional research, your professor at Douglas College, your teaching, but in terms of other issues in your city of Vancouver, what makes you tick? What is it that you like to focus on or you're concerned about?
Cities are everything. I was born in Vancouver. My mom and her mom were city people in Belfast, and I think of the stories that my mom tells me about being raised in Belfast and by a single mom and how hard it was. So I think about that living in the city and, you know, cities are not equitable places, but they ought to be. And I know a lot of efforts are being made toward that. So growing up, being born here, living here, you see the inequity and you see it particularly toward women and women who identify as Indigenous or Black or people of color. And with COVID too, these inequities are really, really visible. Women were disproportionately affected, especially those working in the service sector, service industry. And, you know, in terms of secure housing, violence has really increased during COVID. So you're walking day to day. So you see these kinds of things. And
You're a new board member at OTERA, which is a great organization that provides very good housing for women, I think primarily in the downtown east side, I believe.
I am excited to be a new board member at OTERA. And of course, OTERA is looking to address some of the issues that are particularly facing women and children who are affected by violence by offering them supportive housing. And this is something that's very important, as well as other infrastructural challenges that we face. And in addition to, of course, housing and having secure housing for women and children who are affected by violence. So this is very important to seek these kinds of investments, especially at the local city level. One of the things we've also seen is just a lack of public washroom facilities in the city. And there is definitely a need for these. And a few months ago, I was just at the Vancouver Art Gallery and there's a public washroom there. So there are public washrooms throughout Vancouver, but there's not as many as there used to be. There is a demand for them. So I was waiting in line to use the public washroom behind the art gallery. And when I used it, it was fine. And I came out and there was a woman who was waiting in line next. And I said, oh, I couldn't find the toilet paper. And she says, oh yeah, sometimes it's missing. And she went on to tell me that she uses the washroom daily. That is her washroom because she doesn't have secure housing and she doesn't have access to any other public facilities other than this one. And it really is about dignity. It's about respecting people in the city, so our community, and there is a real need for more public, clean, accessible washrooms. And all other facilities too, facilities where people can go and wash up and clean themselves, that kind of thing, with wraparound services. Yeah.
Well, Jeanette, I love that you go from the global in terms of your study and research, and then you bring it right down to the very immediate local, like access to public washrooms. So that's really a beautiful vision that you have of how you're encompassing all of that. And I just want to say that it's been a real delight to talk with you today. And I wish you well in your studies. And I know we'll look forward to the results of the survey and the studies and the research that you're doing in Canada with the various legislatures and here in BC. It's going to be very, very interesting information that a lot of people want to get their hands on.
I really enjoyed myself. Thank you. And I hope to see more with you soon. Thank you very much.
Now it's time for In Case You Missed It, a little recap of what happened on Rabble.ca this week. This week at Rabble, contributor Brent Patterson goes to the Wet'suwet'en territory and reports on the RCMP's raid of the protesters' blockade there as they defended the land against the Coastal GasLink pipeline project. Just days after the conclusion of the United Nations COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, and amid calls from international groups to stop the criminalization of Indigenous land defenders, militarized police violence against defenders in Canada has seemingly become normalized, Patterson writes. Over 30 people and 3 journalists were arrested on November 18th and 19th last week. It was the third RCMP assault on Wet'suwet'en territory Territory in support of the Coastal GasLink fracked gas pipeline, which is being constructed on their territory without free, prior, and informed consent. The first two raids took place in January and February of this year. Patterson raised some questions about the infrastructure that enabled the raids. RCMP officers were seen arriving at Smithers Airport and being carried away towards the blockade in two white school buses. In the days after the raid, the same make of white school buses were seen emerging from the Coastal GasLink man camp on the Morris River Forest Service Road. That's the road that had been blockaded. This begs the question, were the RCMP using the Coastal GasLink camp to stage their raid? What other state infrastructure did they use to carry it out? Patterson reviews what they've used before and, frankly, identifies this as an appearance of state and industry collusion. Further, Patterson reports there are firsthand witness accounts of the RCMP in Coastal GasLink cars on the territory and RCMP officers arriving in Coastal GasLink marked buses in the nearby town of New Hazleton to break up a rail blockade in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en Nation. According to Patterson, all of this is made worse by the Canadian government's financial involvement in the GasLink project, notably its $275 million investment in June 2019, supporting the LNG Canada export terminal, along with Export Development Canada's $250 million to $500 million loan to Coastal GasLink in May 2020 for the construction of the pipeline. This appearance of collusion between the police and an energy company, along with the disregard of international human rights norms, raise profound concerns that must be addressed, Patterson concludes. Also on the site this week, John Miller reports on a new survey from the Canadian Association of Journalists about who is telling you the news. Thursday, the CAJ released its inaugural measurement of the diversity of people who assign, cover, and present the news. CAJ measured 3,873 news people at 209 media outlets, making it the largest ever survey of the demographics of television and radio broadcasters, online news operations, and daily and community newspapers. Unsurprisingly, the typical Canadian newsroom is not representative of the Canadian population, with more than half of the newsrooms surveyed only employing white journalists. Plus, Carl Nirenberg breaks down the speech from the throne this week, though as he reports, there's not much to break down. It was a speech full of platitudes and lacking in clear commitments, he writes. Catch Nirenberg and our other distinguished panelists next week for our Off the Hill Live Politics panel, where the theme this month is Games of the Throne and the Return of Parliament. MP Leah Gazan will be there, as will Indigenous activist and writer Clayton Thomas Mueller, and poet and scholar Elle Jones. Find all the details of that and so much more at rabble.ca. That's it for this week. If you like the show, please consider subscribing. Rate, review, share it with your friends. You can follow us on social media, across channels, at RabbleCA. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. I'm your host, Chelsea Nash. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk next week. Special thanks to our producer, Brianne Doyle, Libby Davies, and guest, Dr. Jeanette Ash. Thanks to Carl Nirenberg for the music and for his reporting. Thanks to Brent Patterson for his reporting also, and all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca.